No, no, ma'am, this is not a good idea.
Sorry, Goose, but it's time to bust the tower.
And welcome to the second hour of the Danger Zone's, well, second hour of the Danger Zone show, but I call it the Buzz the Tower podcast for the Danger Zone here at the Santa Cruz Voice and KSCO.com. This is the show that for the other items in the stack of stuff that did not make it on to the podcast, the Danger Zone, also at the Santa Cruz Voice and KSCO.com. I am your host, Jim Two, and today is Friday, February 24, 2026. So what else is on the other stack of stuff here? Let's see here. I figure, let's see. Oh. So this is the Iran part of the thing. Because how could you go through and not talk about Iran, right? I mean, that's still the big news. I believe oil was still over $90 a barrel, but it's less than 100. So, you know, who knows what's going on. And let's see here. I guess there's a couple items that came earlier this week from the New York Times. I'm reading this from Zero Hedge because they put me behind a paywall for the New York Times. Ayatollah Mojtaba Khomeini surrounded by 24/7 medical team in hideouts as generals run Iran, New York Times. The New York Times, in a big new deep dive of what the governing structures look like inside the Iran, says what it's already long been obvious to many in the wake of the longtime Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's death. Quote, when Ayatollah Ali Khamenei ruled Iran as supreme leader, he exerted absolute power over all decisions about war, peace, and negotiations in the United States. His son and successor does not play the same role. Publication says it was able to interview at least a half dozen Iranian insiders, including IRGC officials and individuals who know the younger Khamenei well. The New York Times describes Mojtaba Khamenei, quote, his father, his wife, and son were all killed. Access to him is extremely difficult and limited now. He is surrounded mostly by a team of doctors and medical staff who are treating the injuries he sustained in the airstrikes. Apparently, even top trusted generals and the IRGC commanders do visit him for fear of being surveilled and tracked to his location by Israel and the United States. Per source cited in the Times, though Khamenei was gravely wounded, he's mentally sharp and engaged, according to four senior Iranian officials familiar with his health. Yeah, it sounds like Joe Biden, but, you know, hey, he's totally sharp and all that stuff. But we shall see. I think here's another item from Zero Hedge from Wednesday, April 22nd. U.S. drains half its Patriot arsenal during war. New military study finds. Let's see. I think this is also from the Wall Street Journal, but who knows? The seven-week Iran war, currently on pause due to extended ceasefires, raised alarm in Washington over the question of how fast the U.S. has burned through its missile interceptor stockpile. The two-week ceasefire, having just been extended, provided an opportunity to both sides to restock and regroup. A fresh analysis from the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, finds the U.S. military tore through nearly half its Patriot interceptor inventory while heavily draining multiple other critical missile stockpiles. According to CSIS, the Pentagon burned through 50% of its Patriot missiles, more than half of its terminal high-altitude defense THAAD systems designed to counter short, medium, and intermediate range threats, and over 45% of its precision strike missiles, PrISMs, during the Iran air and missile campaign. And the hangover won't be short-term at key replenishing key munitions, including Tomahawks and JASMs, are back to levels where Trump's latest war of choice in the Middle East could take anywhere from 1 to 4 years. Now, you know, a couple of people there are a couple of news reports saying, well, if China decided to invade Taiwan, we don't have enough stuff to defend Taiwan from an invasion. And to which I would say a couple of things. Number one, how would China invade Taiwan? I mean, yeah, sure, they can lob missiles and stuff, but then what, right? They need to, you know, how are you going to fuel your planes that fly or whatever? Or, you know, or your boats or your ships that would cross the Taiwan Strait onto Taiwan. You need oil. You need fuel, fossil fuel, like, you know, aviation fuel, diesel, gasoline. And where does China get 80%? Where does China get 50%? At least 40-50% of its gas, or oil, crude oil, or fossil fuels? The Strait of Hormuz, which is currently blocked off. And where does China get 80% of its fossil fuels? Through the Strait of Malacca, which is basically where Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore all meet. And guess who just made a defense, kind of a defense agreement with Indonesia, the United States. So I don't necessarily think that's necessarily a danger. And of course, given that, you know, the initial strikes basically reduced Iran's ability to lob ballistic missiles. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're going to need to use that many ballistic missile interceptors in a period, you know, anytime soon. But, you know, who knows? You know, the irony is that, you know, when the critics of the Trump administration said, oh, they didn't have clear goals, they didn't have a clear plan or whatever. One, the very first thing I remember Marco Rubio stating as a justification for actually the bombing campaign in Iran was that Iran was building ballistic missiles and drones at a rate faster than we could build the interceptors to stop them. So the Patriots, the THAADs, the Prisms, and Iron Dome, Iron Beam, you know, Broken Arrow or whatever, right? David's Arrow or whatever, right? So if Iran was allowed to persist, even if they didn't have a nuclear weapon, right? They had enough ballistic missiles. They were going to make more ballistic missiles that they could really make a huge nuisance of themselves, such that, you know, they would overwhelm the missile interceptors' systems that would stop them in the region. And of course, given that they also were hiding a 4,000 kilometer long ballistic missiles in their arsenal, which they claim they didn't have and weren't developing, they could threaten about 80% of the European capitals, you know, within their range. Not just Israel, right? You know, all the capitals of Eastern Europe and probably most of Germany, a good chunk of France and the United Kingdom. So take that for what it's worth. Now, also, one of the things is people will say, hey, you know, Iran wasn't a threat. Well, you know, one of the things that Steve Witkoff basically pointed out was during the negotiations before the shooting started was that the Iranian negotiators were bragging that they had enough highly enriched uranium to build 10 to 11 nuclear bombs. And people were saying, oh, that's just not true. Well, you know, take this for what it's worth, my Trump-hating friends, but this is from, I believe, 60 Minutes or whatever. Let me find it here. Okay, let's see here. Okay. Here it is, 60 Minutes. Let's clip.
The war with Iran hinges on three letters, H-E-U, and it's believed Iran has enough of it underground to eventually make 10 nuclear bombs. What would it take for the U.S. to secure that highly enriched uranium? You'll hear about a covert mission that took place 32 years ago and why a similar operation in Iran would be so difficult.
Would an operation like this be worth risking American lives?
In my opinion, yes.
So there you go. Yeah. The thing is, you know, in Operation Midnight Hammer last year, Donald Trump did claim that we obliterated their ability to make nuclear weapons. True. And that we set them back several years. Right. Now, they still have about 1,000 pounds, at least that's what we told, of highly enriched uranium buried under tons of rock and gravel, which is enough to make 10 or 11 nuclear bombs. But let's just say that's not true, or in terms of like that's inaccessible. Right. If you're Trump and you're lying or whatever, okay, you could theoretically give Trump grief for it, and that'd be fair. But then again, if you are him, or if you're the president, right, and you find that you did not, prevent the Iranians from making a nuclear bomb, what would you do, right? Would you just, you know, try to save face and do nothing and pretend that you weren't wrong the first time around? Or would you un-F your mistake, right? And I guess that brings me to a broader question for the Democrats or progressives who are just, you know, sniping at Donald Trump, right? What should we do now? I get that you might think that it was wrong to commence the second round of bombing of Iran, right? Epic Fury, You might, okay, I get that. But now that we're in, now that we're pot committed, so to speak, what do you do now? What would you have done differently, right? Because I think the, you know, the John F. Kerry thing is, well, we should negotiate. And it's like, well, what do you think Witkoff and Jared Kushner have been doing all this time? They've been negotiating. Now, you might say, well, we could negotiate a better deal. Really? I mean, this is from, you know, if you're going to listen to John F. Kerry about, oh, we could have gotten a deal, it's like, well, look at the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the deal that he negotiated with Iran back in the waning days of the Obama administration, right? To which it allowed Iran to enrich uranium. It didn't say anything about supporting terrorist proxies. It didn't say anything about developing ballistic missiles. And even then, what limitations you had on Iran for enriching uranium, apparently they were violating that from day one. So they, you had no way of basically verifying that they were complying with the deal. So, yeah. So maybe, you know, give me something more, right? Because the thing is, what do we do now, Democrats? Other than, you know, we can impeach Donald Trump or, you know, like certain members of Congress. I guess they want to impeach Pete Hegseth, right? Okay, but what do you do about Iran now? I think that's a fair question. If you're a Democrat, what should we do now? But yeah, who knows? I mean, it's one of those little things that you go. But I guess this is another swing in the other totally new subject here, right? and this is, I guess, progressives expressing bad thoughts, I guess the case may be. But this is from Racket News Matt Taibbi, because again, the New York Times puts everything behind a paywall these days. New York Times: old people suck and we should take their stuff. The subhead is, it's time to do with these societal grifters and stowaways, says eminent Yale professor. Well, I don't know about eminent, but Yale professor, April 21st, right? The New York Times on old people. Quoting from the New York Times, it is not ageist to ask whether old people should be required to give more to younger Americans. Older Americans favor restrictions on immigration. There is a correlation between age and resistance to policies to halt the overheating of the planet. Impose age ceilings on political offices. Older Americans own much more of the desirable real estate. It is not ageist, finally, to impose policies to transfer jobs, houses, and wealth down the generational chain. Yeah, I'm assuming Yale law professor Samuel Moyne, whom I interviewed once, always seemed generous and reasonable, even when our politics differed. But unless it's an elaborate meta joke, the above column and the forthcoming book Gerontocracy in America, How the Old Are Hoarding Wealth and Power in America, advance some of the most intellectually vicious ideas I've ever seen. The Godwin's Law factor alone is a shocker. Moyne observes that people of years, that's old people for you folks in Wine Moms and Capitola, have accumulated money and influence and contrives to end the tyranny of the old by having the elderly divested of political power, wealth, and property because reasons. Well, the title of the Times piece, quote, "Older Americans are hoarding America's potential," carries the obscene lefty connotation that no one really owns anything. And the elderly, by dint of living too long to begin with and having a generally crappy quality of life compared to the young, and voting incorrectly, selfishly, hilarious in the context of open scheming to seize their savings and wasting resources, quote, playing for a time for another day, month, or year among loved ones, makes them lousy stewards of what the author unironically calls our inheritance, i.e. their homes and bank accounts. Moyne cites the example of apes and chimpanzees, who establish hierarchies based on brute strength and therefore physical vitality, and can marginalize faltering alpha males who then sometimes go into exile, which means death. Humans, by unpleasant contrast, traditionally value the wisdom of elders, so achieving intergenerational equity may require, here Moyne quotes the secession character of Shiv Roy, a good old-fashioned dinosaur cult. The piece doesn't just see the collectivist bloodlust. It's incorrect. Moyne confuses a handful of old politicians and billionaires with a wider category of old people who, far from being antisocial hoarders, have been repeatedly victimized by public and private interests over the last 20 plus years, always for the same offense, being good citizens. I'd say it's astonishing that a Yale professor could not know this, but sadly it isn't. And someone who has never has had to cover the ripoffs, it's lunacy. Yeah, I would say so. And I'm going to guess Mr. Moyne is not old, you know, because with wisdom comes years and, you know, you get old. And I guess maybe he just wants old people to die. You know, once you retire, you just die because, you know, your contribution to society is negligible after you retire. Right. But, you know, and of course, the fact, the idea, the notion that other people's, that you are entitled to other people's stuff is kind of, on a general sense, right? If someone stole something from you, okay, I can understand that. But just the fact that they earned the money, they spent their money, bought stuff, and now you think you're entitled to their stuff is kind of weird, but who knows? Maybe that's a New York Times or Progressive thing. Here's from the New York Post, also from the progressives who have crazy thoughts. Anti-capitalist New Yorker writer bragged she stole from Whole Foods on several occasions in a New York Times podcast. This is by Caitlin McCormick, April 22nd. A longtime staffer for the New Yorker, known for bashing capitalism, bragged that she has stolen from her local Whole Foods on several occasions in a New York Times podcast. Gia Tolentino, 37, made a shocking admission while joining left-wing streamer Hassan Piker and Times opinion culture editor Nadja Spiegelman for a Wednesday episode about so-called micro-looting from mega corporations. Examples tossed around by the trio range from everyday consumers sharing passwords for streaming services to brazen criminals pilfering paintings from the Louvre Museum. Yeah, that's a big range. Anyways, when Spiegelman suggested pocketing produce from Whole Foods, Tolentino confessed she already had on several occasions. The scribe said one of her duties as a member of a ritzy Brooklyn neighborhood's mutual aid group was to buy groceries for one of her neighbors, Miss Nancy. Quote, and so I was, I'd be getting Ms. Nancy all of her groceries. Then I would finish and I'd be like, oh my God, four lemons. I forgot four lemons. And on several occasions, I was like, I'm just going to go back in, grab those four lemons and get the hell out, Tolentino said. Quote, at the time I was like, I had not been to Whole Foods. I had been a bit more consumer discipline. I had a bit more consumer discipline about where I was spending my money. Then I already felt like I was in the hole even by shopping there. And it certainly felt in a utilitarian sense. I was like, this is not a big deal, she added. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. It's just this weird, crazy, crazy sense of entitlement that makes me just want to wonder what is the matter with you people. But, you know, and just the thought that, you know, but you can, I mean, maybe it's a different mindset from me as a conservative, right? If it's not your stuff, you don't get to take it, right? Without permission, right? You're not entitled to other people's stuff. And I think the these progressives like Professor Moyne and Ms. Tolentino, they have a sense of entitlement. You are entitled to take other people's stuff. And I think that might be the dividing line between conservatives and progressives these days. Or maybe certain progressives are saying the quiet part out loud. Deep down inside, they don't believe in the concept of ownership and private property. They think that's wrong. And that they are deep down, if you dig deep down inside, they're communists at heart, collectivists. I get to take your stuff because I need it, right? Even though that's more of a loot, that is more of a looting mentality than anything else. So take that for what it's worth. Now, I guess, you know, not to be a big bummer, but let's focus on some better news, as the case may be. There's been a lot of SNAP and EBT fraud going down. I think, you know, the bill, one big, beautiful bill decided to have work requirements for SNAP or whatever. And everyone was all progressives are all freaking out. How dare you make people work for their food stamps or at least try to work? And granted, if it was like you have to go down to a coal mine or whatever and slave away, I can kind of see that. But, you know, the thing is, the ironic thing was the work requirements themselves were very, very mild, right? Like, you had to at least work like 18 hours or 20 hours a week, or at least be looking for a job, or you'd be in school or job training, or you're caring for like an adult relative, or you have minor children, right? Now, if you have, I think the one was, if you had like children over the, if your kids were over the age of 13, then okay, then you had to, the number of hours you had to work per week was reduced, right? From whatever the ridiculously low number of hours you had to work in the first place. So, but there was a lot of fraud going on apparently, because apparently illegal aliens were signing up for it because state agencies were the ones that were assigned the task of actually doling out the money, doling out the benefits. And apparently a lot of blue state agencies that were in charge just didn't decide to check for citizenship apparently, or amongst other things. Like in California, there were anecdotal stories, and I don't know if this is still true or not, where you got an EBT, you got a debit card from EBT, right? It's the EBT card for your food stamps. And in California, you could go to an ATM machine and you stick the EBT card in, type in your PIN code, and get cash. So there were anecdotal stories of people that would go to an ATM machine in a strip club, put their EBT card in, get cash, and pay for lap dances. Or they would go to an ATM machine, you know, get the cash, you know, and go get a tattoo at a tattoo parlor or something like that. Or buy liquor, as the case may be. But this is from, I'm assuming Florida doesn't have this, because Florida, this is from the healthysnap.myfamilies.com, myflfamilies.com, so myfloridafamilies.com. And they just announced new changes that began on April 20. And apparently, the SNAP benefits in Florida will no longer compensate for these four items: soda, energy drinks, candy, or ultra-processed prepared desserts, right? Yeah, I mean, so they're not paying for soda and energy drinks. I wonder if they pay for alcohol too, but you know, but again, maybe Florida has the same thing that California had, where you can just get cash, withdraw cash from your EBT card, and get a lap dance at a strip club. I think maybe not, but you know, I could be wrong on that point, but you know, I do, you know, I do miss the lap dances with my EBT card in California. But anyways, more good news. Washington, D.C. homicides plunge 52% as National Guard deployment changes city's crime landscape, by Scott McClellan at townhall.com, April 18. The number of homicides in Washington, D.C. has dropped steeply after President Donald Trump set the National Guard to clean up the city in August of 2025. There have been 20 homicides in 2026 so far in the nation's capital, which is a 52% drop compared to 42 homicides recorded in the same period of 2025, according to D.C. police statistics. In all of 2025, the city recorded 127 homicides. The city recorded 187 homicides in 2024. So that's about a 33% drop for you wine moms in Capitola. Data show that many categories of violent crime have plunged as of 4 months into 2026. Homicides are down 52%, as previously mentioned. Sex abuse is down 48%. Granted, Eric Swalwell wasn't there for many of the votes, but, you know, that's just him. Robbery is down 23%. Motor vehicle theft is down 56%. All crime is down 25%. Let's see here. So, yeah, so that's pretty, so that's good news. Heaven forbid that having more law enforcement in an urban center where result in less crime. I know it's a scary thought. It's like, but that costs taxpayer money. Yeah, that's what your taxpayers' money is for. But just, you know, whatever. Yeah, and of course, you remember all those people wanted to defund the police after 2020 and, you know, whatever. And then they actually defunded the police in all these major blue cities, or, well, most big cities are blue, but the ones run by crazy progressives. And then crime spiked up. What a concept. And then they had to rehire everybody back, or now they're still shorthanded. Oh, good on you. But let's see here. What else is in the good old stack of stuff? Oh, yeah. Remember, we had a air traffic controller shortage that led to, you know, certain airports having to reduce their flight loads or whatever. Also, you know, there were some air crashes that the media made note of and saying, oh, it's all Sean Duffy's fault. This didn't happen under Pete Buttigieg. Well, you know, the traffic of air controls occurred under Pete Buttigieg because he implemented DEI policies that weeded out a lot of very well-qualified applicants in favor of, you know, women and people of color applicants that were less qualified. So, but how do you, we got rid of the DEI requirements, but how do you make up for the shortage of air traffic controllers? Well, the current Department of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy came up with a pretty good idea. PJmedia.com, 6,000 apply as air traffic controllers after DOT Secretary Duffy proposes recruiting gamers. This is by Brian S. Jung, April 18th. U.S. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy declared the Federal Aviation Administration's FAA campaign to recruit video gamers as air traffic controllers is wildly successful after nearly 6,000 applicants submitted forms within the first 12 hours of the program's launch. The FAA is reporting thousands of applicants applied after unconventional new recruitment initiative launched on April 17 with an application of portal reaching its cap of 8,000 candidates. The Trump administration is currently looking to address a persistent nationwide shortage of air traffic controllers, as many of the most experienced have retired in recent years. Quote, to the extent the next generation of air traffic controllers, we need to adapt, Duffy said in a statement. The campaign's innovative communication style and focus on gaming taps into the growing demographic of young adults who may have had hard who may have many of the hard skills it takes for be a successful controller, unquote. So yeah. So will they all end up being air traffic controllers? Eh, maybe. But, you know, the thing is, the fact that they're getting more people to apply, you know, is a good thing. You know, I mean, you think just with the sheer dumb luck of odds that you get at least, you get at least 5 to 10% of them, maybe turn out, but who knows? This is from the American Thinker, which is regard to our lovely Supreme Court. Hags, two Supreme Court justices are reportedly bosses from hell on their clerk and staff, new book alleges. This is from the American Thinker, April 21st, by Monica Showalter. Why are Democrats so loaded with nasty, vicious women? ? A new book by respected Washington columnist and editor Molly Hemingway came out with some doozies of information about the sheer unbearableness of Supreme Court Justices Elena Kagan and Sotomayor, who are apparently nightmares to work for all who come into their orbit. According to the Daily Mail, in her forthcoming book, Alito, The Justice Who Reshaped the Supreme Court and Restored the Constitution, conservative journalist and author Molly Hemingway lifts the lid on the justices' treatment of clerks. Hemingway, who spoke to over 100 former clerks and staff for the book, sensationally claims that liberal justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor are the worst justices to clerk for. Hemingway alleges that several of Kagan's clerks, along with others of the court, have described her as emotionally abusive, demanding, demoralizing, demeaning, and a hard ass. Kagan's clerks had fear in their eyes, Hemingway said, someone who clerked for a different justice recounted to her. Other former aides speculated there's something psychological going on there, Hemingway writes. Other clerks compared Kagan to Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, moving from extremely kind and to extremely angry, Hemingway claims. Another former staffer said Kagan is like Klobuchar, a reference to the Democrat Senator Amy Klobuchar, who was a subject of a New York Times article about her alleged poor treatment of her staff. Meanwhile, Sotomayor is said to have treated members of the court's permanent staff like valets. I think those are not law clerks. I think those are just like office clerks or whatever, right? There's a known stories of Sotomayor barking at them to help her carry her bags per Hemingway's book. Hemingway describes Kagan and Sotomayor's behavior as distinct from her colleagues, from their colleagues, and notes that most former clerks and permanent staff members have great opinions of their former bosses. All the other justices are humane and civilized, but a pair of them has chosen to go the other way, acting like Anna Wintour's The Devil Wears Prada fame and a top Democrat fundraiser by abusing those beneath them, confident in their own reflected glory. In some ways, it sounds like Cesar Chavez, albeit with not involving sexual predation. There you go. But the misery is real enough for those who work under these over-celebrated historical firsts who, like Caesar, have let it go to their heads. Maybe the best argument against affirmative action hires, given the frequency of this kind of prima donna-ism. It's probably impossible that some conservative women have acted this way, but I Can't think of any instances, but it's very, very common to see such mean, abusive people on the left. Think of Hillary Clinton throwing her lamps at ashtrays and ordering staff not to dare look at her, as has been described in Gary Aldrich's expose from the 1990s and Limited Access. Think of Senator Amy Klobuchar screaming at her staff and eating soup with a comb. It was eating salad with a comb. But anyways, think of former Rep. Katie Porter, that's a callback, hurling a pot of hot mashed potatoes onto her ex-husband, now ex-husband, screaming at a staffer to get out of my shot on camera. Think of Jill Biden, known as Lady Macbeth, who reportedly considered punishment duty by the Secret Service staff. Think of the late unlamented Sheila Jackson Lee, who drew the dubious honor of the meanest member of Congress for profane and demeaning treatment of her own staff, as well as heavy demands on a staff to treat her like a queen. Now we have Kagan, who is some psycho thing going on, apparently to see fear in the eyes of her clerks, and Sotomayor, who treats clerks like waitstaff. It's anonymous sources. So take it with a grain of salt. And the easiest way is to have the former clerks of Sotomayor and Kagan basically go on record as saying, no, she was great. They're great. Now, the irony in the book also basically lists the two justices that were notoriously nice and wonderful to work for. And those were Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito, who is the title character, the title whose name is in the title of Molly Hemingway's book. So I don't know if that's necessary. I don't know if you can necessarily draw a trend of progressives being jerks and conservatives being nice people from that. Because again, you know, when you're talking about 40% of the population for both groups, there's always going to be nice people and jerks in both subsets. The question is, is the distribution different, so to speak, right? Is it such that, is it different in the sense that, conservatives are nicer than progressives? Who knows? It depends. I think it'll depend on the context, but we'll see. Now, it makes it extra interesting because I think the book also lists some news in the sense that when the Dobbs decision a couple years ago on abortion was leaked, right? Basically, the decision had already been written, right? So all you had to do was publish it, release the opinion, and it would the case would have been decided, right? But then the memo leaked before it was released, and it was pretty clear that the court was going to overturn Roe v. Wade. And what was delaying the release of the publication of the decision was the dissent. The dissenters, the liberal justices, basically were slow. They were slow to get their dissents in, right? And they were intentionally doing it. It's not like they were having a difficulty writing the dissent. I know it might seem that way, but no, they were slow in writing the dissent. And what made it extra spicy is that the conservative justices were getting death threats after the leak of the draft of the Dobbs decision. And the conservative justices were forced to wear bulletproof vests. They had to have 24-hour marshal service, right? One person even actually showed up in front of Brett Kavanaugh's home with the firearm, right? So you have the conservative justices begging the liberal justices to get their dissents in so that at least when the decision came out, then they can weather the storm and then the threat would end sooner. And apparently the liberal justices did not do that. Or at least I think Breyer was willing to release, according to Molly Hemingway's book, Breyer was willing to release the decision or his dissent early, but apparently Elena Kagan was yelling at Breyer for doing so. So we have that. And of course that has an interesting relation because apparently the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act case is allegedly now, according to Sean Spicer, being drafted or being written by Justice Alito, which indicates to a lot of people that the racial gerrymandering to include majority minority districts, basically gerrymandering to ensure that minority members will be elected to Congress, basically favoring the Democrats, is going to be struck down as being racially discriminatory under the Equal Protection Clause. But the rumor is, according to Spicer, is that the decision's written, it's ready to go. The only thing now that's delaying the publication of the decision are the liberal justices, the progressive justices, who are slow walking, submitting, getting their dissents in. And they want to lay it such to the fact that when the decision comes out, there's not enough time for all the southern states to redistrict to reflect the new ruling. Because if that was the case, about 12, they estimate about anywhere from 10 to 12 congressional seats would swing towards Republicans, which would offset what's going on in Virginia. By the way, a judge in Virginia basically held the redistricting initiative unconstitutional in the state constitution, but the Virginia Supreme Court is going to be looking at it. So we'll see what happens there in that case, but you never know. Let's see here. Oh, but even though this might be a crazy idea to fix Virginia, because really, if you're a conservative, right? Because Virginia, for the most part, if you look at it, like the northern part of Virginia, which is right outside of D.C., is very, very liberal, which because that's where all the federal government workers live, right? And so because, you know, you can make a lot of money working for the federal government, you know, there are a lot of people who live there. And they're all Democrats because they know where their bread is buttered for the most part, right? And so that basically tilts the state that we normally relatively the rest of the state is relatively conservative. It tilts the state blue, right? And that's how you, and by the gerrymander that they approved in the voter initiative, basically everything just kind of tickles into that one county in Northern Virginia. I think it's Fairfax County. And then just kind of spreads it out so that you basically turn a 6-5 Democrat to Republican congressional delegation into a 10-1. But anyways, but here's an idea. This is from townhall.com by Amy Curtis, April 23rd. While Virginia redistricting referendum goes to court, there's another option to counter Jem's Democrats' gerrymander. And what she proposes is there's an act called Make D.C. Square Again. And what that would do is originally D.C. consisted of that northern part of Virginia, Fairfax County, right? Because basically, D.C. was a square, and it included the southern part of Maryland and the northern part of Virginia, right? But sometime in 1847, the part of D.C. that was south of the Potomac, the Virginia half, was ceded back to Virginia after D.C. banned slavery, right? So the northern part of Virginia that was originally part of D.C., I think it's Arlington and Alexandria are the cities in there, are part of Virginia, and they're very blue, and that one part tilts the entire state back to slightly blue. So there's an act to basically reincorporate that part of Northern Virginia back into D.C., and basically so all those people that live in Fairfax County would no longer be citizens of Virginia, they'd be citizens of D.C., and therefore their votes would not count in Virginia elections. I don't know if that's going to work. I would suspect that you would have to get by a legislative filibuster. But who knows? Let's see what else is there on the stack of stuff here. let's see. Oh, this is in the pop culture element. Disney tacitly admits it made a multi-billion-dollar mistake with Star Wars Land. This is by Fox News, April 17. Just a few short years ago, that Walt Disney was proudly announcing and opening their Star Wars themed land in multiple parks across the country. Disney invested billions of dollars into Star Wars Galaxy's Edge design and construction based on fictional world of Batuu. They hyped up technology and immersive events meant to enhance the guest experience and allow for fans to spend hours in Galaxy Edge. So, you know, think a sci-fi version of Frontierland or a Star Wars themed version of Tomorrowland, as the case may be. Now, the problem is, Batuu was purposely set in a world of the newest trilogy, led by characters like Rey and Kylo Ren, thanks to advice from then head of Lucasfilm Kathleen Kennedy to then Disney CEO Bob Iger. Let's see here. And now, after just a few short years of operation, new leadership at the top is completely changing the plan behind the Star Wars Galaxy Edge. In the process, admitting the company missed the mark for their multi-billion-dollar project. Star Wars Land, bringing back original characters. So basically what Kathleen Kennedy did was when they opened up Galaxy's Edge in Disneyland and Disney World, they focused on, you know, the third trilogy, episodes 7, 8, and 9, right? New Hope, Force Awakens, let's see, The Last Jedi, and I forget what the last one is, Rise of Skywalker, right? Okay, so, but And they ignored the original trilogy, the OG trilogy of Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. So less Luke, Leia, and Darth Vader and Han Solo, and more Kylo Ren, Finn, and Rey, right? And it turns out, you know, a lot of people didn't like the third trilogy, and they lost billions of dollars as a result. Of course, I could have told you that, but, you know, hey, but a Disney executive basically admitted this. Let's see here. We got a call one day. They said former Walt Disney World Vice President Dan Cockrell. They said, we got some news, y'all, the Imagineering guys. They've heard this many, many times in their careers, and I've never been through this. Well, yesterday, Bob Iger met with Kathleen Kennedy, who a lot of people said are sort of George Lucas' protege and head of Lucasfilm. They had a conversation. They had this meeting. Kathleen Kennedy, her point of view was that there's more Star Wars stories ahead of us than behind us. So we should really look to build a Tatooine and build what was a 50-something remember Star Wars, or do we want to build something else, which is to appeal to the upcoming generations and going to know the new stories? Well, those 50-something Gen Xers, screw them, right? Even though they're the ones with kids and they're the ones with the money, but hey, you know, the Gen Zers and the Millennials and the Alpha Generation, they're going to love Kylo Ren and Rey. No, they don't. But anyways, so they're at a cost of billions of dollars. Of course, you know, don't even get me started on the their hotel, the Galactic Star Cruiser or something, I believe it was the name is. But anyways, also in the weird stack of stuff here, this is from Zero Hedge. I'm not sure if this is the internet trolling me or not, but this is catching print. New feminist trend proves they have smooth brains. Sunday, April 19. For decades, insecure women have used feminism as a vehicle to crusade against body shaming and male objectification, which is essentially a war on men who dare to have beauty preferences. Nearly every feminist movement has roots in female physical insecurity, from fat positivity movement to the slut walk protests to diversity requirements that are eliminating attractive women from popular media to the inversion movement in which average women deliberately make themselves uglier in rebellion against men who were never interested in them in the first place. It's no secret that female insecurity rules almost everything women do politically. Well, I don't know about that, but okay, let's go with it. One could say that feminism is essentially the weaponization of female insecurity as a means to gain power over society. That I can kind of agree with, but okay, you know, I just figure, you know, it used to be just like, let the girls have a chance in doing what the guys are doing. After that, then it got a little weird. But anyways, especially, you know, how it got weird was when we redefined men into women. That was just, I think that's when it jumped the shark, but that's just my opinion. But anyways, as a black lesbian in transition, I can say that. But anyways, the latest trend to spew from the bowels of feminist activism is called catching print. Activists claim men are objectifying and shaming women, so women should objectify and shame men by staring at and rating men's junk. The problem is, these people don't seem to understand that the vast majority of men simply don't care. The trend is, of course, going viral on the cesspool sites like TikTok, and is being popularized by leftist media sites like The Cosmopolitan. But it does offer a perfect opportunity to peer into the mentality of the lowest common denominator, understand why marginalizing them is necessary. The idea that men are worried about what grotesque feminists think of them is desperate fantasy. However, these dumpy ladies have the problem covered. They simply pretend as if men are up in arms about the trend and are scrambling to hide the bulge in their pants from prying eyes. As always, feminists build a straw man on social media, then tear them down. It's sad, but it makes them feel powerful. I wouldn't necessarily say this is just feminists. It's all progressives in general, but that's just me. Men sit with their legs spread for a reason. They're never worried about who is looking. Plus, you know, you don't want to squeeze it. Just because. If anything, it would appear that activist women are jealous of modern men's ability to remain indifferent to women's judgments. And to be clear, the idea of women trying to shame men into conformity is not new. Narcissistic females have been shaming as a manipulation tactic since the dawn of time. Almost every man in the world has been accused of having a small unit by a woman who has trying to distract from the fact that she was wrong. Women invented body shaming mostly to undermine other women out of jealousy. Men's brains do not operate in the same manner. What feminists call body shaming is often nothing more than men having standards and preferences who they date. In the liberal West, women are applauded and rewarded for having extreme and often absurd preferences, 6 feet, six-figure income, six-pack abs. Men are demonized merely for not dating fat chicks. Who knows? that might be going a little bit on the far side, but I'm hoping that this is the internet trolling me and that this thing doesn't catch on. Now, there are a lot of things that people try to latch onto and create as a trend and doesn't work, but you know, all I can say is that, you know, when we see a physically attractive woman, we are men are heterosexual men are biologically programmed to look, right? Now, if you start stalking them or you stare for too long, okay, maybe that's a little creepy, but you know, if it's just that, it's not a crime. Yeah. And maybe civility, you should look away or whatever. Great. But you know, physically mutilating yourself with tattoos and odd piercings and weird hair coloring, you know, that is your right. I don't necessarily think that's a good thing. But then again, if you don't want male attention, might I suggest a septum ring? That will keep a certain type of man away from you, ladies. Staring at their junk is probably going to get their attention. Well, it might get a man's attention, but if it may not, but if it does, I bet you it's not the good time. Good kind of attention, as the case may be. But what can you do? It is what it is. And of course, if you start staring at men's junk and rating them and this becomes a thing, don't be complaining when all of a sudden you get penis pics sent to you via text. Because I always thought that women didn't want to see men's junk. Well, as a general rule, but you know, hey, who am I to say, right? That's just me. But anyways, I think we are at the end of our podcast. Oh my God, I finally got through my stack of stuff here. That never really happens. But anyways, so thank you for joining me here on the Danger Zone's Buzz the Tower podcast. I've been your host, Jim 2. This is at the Santa Cruz Voice and KSEO.com. So I will join you at a later date and have a great weekend.